The 1994 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session number 330, a panel discussion, The Song of Songs and the Mormon Blues, Eros in LDS Life and Literature.
We would like to begin this session. This session is sponsored by the Association for Mormon Letters, and I'd like to begin by giving you a little introduction. Oh, you can't hear? Now can you hear me? You have to talk right into the mic. Okay. The Association for Mormon Letters is an organization to promote Mormon literature, to promote the reading and study and writing of Mormon literature. And we would really like to encourage all of you, or invite all of you to join the Association for Mormon Letters if you would like to. We have a newsletter that comes out 4 times a year, and in that newsletter there are reviews of 5 or 6 new Mormon books. So you find out what has recently been published, and you get a review of it. We have an annual conference for members to attend and present papers. This year at our conference, our guest speaker is going to be Wayne Booth. He's a well-known literary critic who's had quite an impact on the field of literature, and he has Mormon roots. He's raised in American Fork, Utah. And what he has to tell us about ourselves and about our own literature, I think, is going to be very important. He'll be here in January 13th and 14th of next year. We sponsor readings throughout the year of well-known and up-and-coming writers, often as they publish new books. And we present annual awards for the best books published in several fields, in poetry, the novel, short story, essay, children's literature and young adult literature, family history and autobiography, drama, and then other special categories. And we sponsor sessions at such events as this symposium, the Rocky Mountain Modern Language Association. And this year, especially, for some reason unbeknownst to us, we have not been able to publish our proceedings for the last 5 years, but now we have them. Here they are. You get the proceedings. You get all the papers that are presented as a part of your membership. This year, you happen to get the last 5 years' worth. And there is really fine material in these proceedings. It's 2 volumes, 350 total pages, including works by such people as Bruce Jorgensen here on our panel, talking about Mormon literature, a theory of what readers should be like. Richard Craycroft responding rather vigorously and harshly to Bruce Jorgensen. We have essays by Emma Lou Thane here, by Bert Wilson. There's a lot of good material, and you can either buy these for $15, or you can join the Association for Mormon Letters for $15 and get them for free. So, and it's only $12 for students, so we'd really like to encourage you if you'd be interested. I'll be at the back of the room with these lovely forms. You can fill them out and pay your money at the table where they're selling T-shirts and things and pick up these volumes. They're available to you right today. Now that I've gone on at length about that, let me introduce Bruce Jorgensen, who will introduce the other panel members. Bruce Jorgensen is a professor of English at the Institution to the South at Brigham Young University, and he is a fine writer. Bruce Jorgensen first came to my attention when he won the church's writing contest for a short story, and they published that story. It is one of the most interesting, complex, and emotionally powerful stories that I'd ever read. And it's a Mormon story. And he's continued that tradition of writing with care and precision. This past year, he won the Utah Arts Council Award for the short story, and his work has also been recently published in the High Plains Literary Review. And I will let Bruce introduce the other members of the panel and the topic that they're going to talk about today.
Thank you, Susan. I do want to present myself today really as a reader and a writer. Sometimes that sort of professional kind of reader we know of as a literary critic. The AML board, by way of Susan, invited me some time ago to consider chairing a panel here on something like sex and love in Mormon literature, and I wondered if I was thought to be some sort of expert. There was no question that I am interested, and that's been clear in some of my published remarks related to that topic, especially a response here in 1986 to a paper by Levi Peterson. Both Levi's paper and mine were later published in Dialogue. And some of my published fiction would also show that, including the story which Susan mentioned, well, in fact, both of them indirectly, the story in The Ensign in 1979 called A Song for One Still Voice. That's the title it has in Greening Wheat. And the story that was published just this spring in High Plains Literary Review, which is called Who Jane, Who Tarzan. And both of those stories, in fact, draw on the Song of Solomon, Who Jane, Who Tarzan, quite consciously, and A Song for One Still Voice, somewhat unconsciously, though as I've looked back, I've said, my goodness, you know, it was always there. I think when this topic comes up, there are, in fact, no disinterested or uninterested parties, though there are plenty of people in other rooms at this symposium at this moment. But if you're Mormon, that includes God. Even God is not disinterested in this topic. Maybe little kids, I said to myself, remembering how some of mine drifted away one long Sunday afternoon when we tried to talk with them about it. There are no disinterested parties. And I would suspect that in this room, all of us are in some sense expert, say in the root sense of that word, one who has had some experience of the topic concerned. So I I come at it that way. I had originally envisioned something much more ambitious. It seems to me when this topic comes up that the discussion ought to range into biology, into culture, into history, that it should not be a merely literary discussion. But some of the original panelists that I tried to convene for it convinced me that that was far too ambitious, that we would get next to nothing said, and that we really ought to have a symposium on the topic all by itself. Well, we've suggested that to Albert, and we'll see. But so I recreated the panel. It has evolved, and now I hope not too disappointingly will be a mainly literary discussion. I would actually have preferred the larger, much wider-ranging discussion, but I was, I think, rightly persuaded that it was nearly infeasible to do that. As a writer and a reader, and a critic and a teacher of writing and reading and criticism, especially of fiction, it has seemed to me that I and other Mormon readers and writers feel ourselves, to one degree or another, under a prohibition or stigmatized when and where our texts touch on what discussions of Greek romances call erotic apothemata, incidents of love, love sufferings, the sorrows and joys of Eros. The prohibitions on reading the discourse of Eros, the story that Eros makes in our lives, are explicit and often apostolic, and thus have to be taken quite seriously. For a number of months now, I've been teaching alternate weeks, Course 15 in the Sunday School, and the manual which I've used for that includes a statement made in 1974 by a leader who was not then but is now an apostle, who says this: for your own good, avoid the promotional literature of illicit sexual relations. Pornographic or erotic stories and pictures are worse than filthy or polluted food, because this marvelous retrieval system we call a brain won't vomit back filth. Once recorded, it will always remain subject to recall, flashing its perverted images across your mind and drawing you away from the wholesome things in life. I discussed that poison metaphor, by the way, or bad food metaphor, in 1986, though I hadn't at that time seen this statement, and its very interesting shift to a computer memory metaphor, or what now sounds like CD-ROM, and apparently CD-ROM with a power of its own. You know, it doesn't have to be addressed. And I really don't feel I have time to discuss here the the complexity of even that very brief statement. I see a great deal in it that I didn't see the first time I read it. The way that it conflates pornographic and erotic in a way that I would not want to, or its equation of both of those with the depiction of illicit sexual relations, that's a problem, and its implicit exclusion of the erotic from the wholesome things of life, that's another problem, and that's only the beginning of what I see in that statement. I hope it's clear, by the way, that speaking here as a scribe, as I always do, and not as one having authority, that I mean to speak as much as I can, as scribes prefer to, of texts and not of persons. I don't want to make any criticisms of any person, but I will criticize texts. Well, I think there are implicit prohibitions or stigma, a kind of stigma, on a Mormon writer who tries to write about sex. It comes up in my own writing group, for instance, when my wife asks, with some humor but with real intent, as the scriptures say, and referring to all the male members in the group, if you'll pardon that word, she'll say, why do you boys have to write about sex all the time? Well, we don't all the time. But she says, it's like you're trying to outdo each other, and I don't think we are. But she feels that way if and when we do. Or the sense of a prohibition is there if I overhear a colleague giving the same a version of the same question, wondering why so many so-called serious Mormon writers seem obsessed, I don't think they are, with writing about sex. And I think those are, it's a good question, worth addressing, and I hope to address it at least some here. It seems, though, I find myself much more exercised by the questions of how we write and read sex. It seems to me that, in fact, we don't read the erotic very well. Maybe we can't read it. We're blinded to it or blinded by it or deafened. And maybe there are good reasons for that. But as I've said, there are no disinterested parties. And in fact, all of us, men and women, we bear the stigmata of sex. It's literal marks on our bodies. It's powers in our souls. From birth, from before birth, till death and beyond, as Mormonism teaches us. And maybe it behooves us then to learn to read it as well as we can, to read the stories and the songs of Eros. Being human, it's hard to avoid this. And believing in a God who has sex, we are, as in my awareness, the only Christians, the only Western monotheists, if we are monotheists, who take radically seriously the idea that God is male and a father, which means that he has a female counterpart and that he has her or them or whatever the situation is in order to beget us as his literal children. We do not talk metaphor when we say God the Father. Well, we all know that. Try to say something interesting, Jorgensen. I hope I will before I'm through. Anyway, it just seems to me that it's hard for us to avoid that. I have thought that the place to start a discussion, at least a literary discussion, of this topic would be within the sacred texts, with the Song of Solomon, which is unfortunately a problematic text, and I'll go into that in a minute. And the title that I proposed to the symposium organizers, I should explain just briefly, is one that I thought of about 1980 or 1981 as a title for an essay that I thought maybe I'd write. Now, I don't know whether I will or not, though all the homework I've done getting ready for this persuades me maybe I will. By Mormon blues, I had meant generally our various troubles with sexuality, and more specifically, a certain faint, thin, high humming or keening that I thought I kept hearing in the music of a lot of Mormon marriages, including my own. The blues ain't nothing but a good man or a woman feeling bad, I've heard tell. And Woody Guthrie, I really love how Woody Guthrie puts this about what the blues is. Well, the blues. I always just called plain old being lonesome, thinking maybe that you're down and out, disgusted and busted and can't be trusted. Gives you a lonesome feeling that somehow the world sort of turned against you or there's something about it you don't understand. Being lonesome. Anyway, that's Woody. I was wondering when I wrote Song of Songs and whether Solomon's rapturous canticles might offer any useful wisdom, though now I wonder also if the Song of Songs might also sing the Mormon and the human blues. That's where I'm coming from. That's all I think I have time to do of my too voluminous introduction to the topic itself. I want to briefly introduce my two friends here on the panel, and then I'll make a statement about the Song of Songs itself, a kind of preliminary statement, and then invite them to make their statements. I've told them that I do not feel they are obliged to address the Song of Songs directly. I'm plenty prepared to do that. That I thought of that as merely a starting point, a text that most people would have some awareness of, and that I could give you a little more about. So let me introduce my friends and fellow panelists here. Margaret Young is the author of two novels, House Without Walls, published by Bookcraft, and Salvador, published by Aspen, and a story collection, Elegies and Love Songs, which obviously is her qualification for being on the panel, published by the University of Idaho Press. I've read a draft of Margaret's current novel, In Progress, which deals with marriage, and that was another reason that I wanted to invite her to be on the panel. She also has a new short story collection. I think it's called Love Chains, or that's at least the working title, which she's hoping Signature will publish very soon. Hope I'm accurate about this, Margaret. Karen Anderson England, who's the chairman of the English department currently at Utah Valley State College, is the writer, is mainly a nonfiction prose writer, the author of an essay called The Man at the Chapel, which won the Lowell Benyon Prize after its publication in Dialogue some years ago, and then the AML Award for Best Personal Essay in that year. She's published a short story called Miscarriage in Dialogue, has published a number of reviews in the AML newsletter and BYU Studies. She says her greatest accomplishment over the last 5 years is bearing and beginning to rear three kids, and that this past year on mommy leave, she's written a great deal. And one of the things she's been working on is an essay in preparation for publication in Dialogue, I believe, called Near Sex Experiences, about growing up as a good Mormon girl. So I think both my friends here are eminently qualified. And as I say, I don't regard them as obliged to talk about the Song of Songs. I'll do that now for just a few minutes, and then turn the time over to Margaret and then Karen, and then we'll see where things go from there. Around the first century of the Common Era, or first century AD, if you want to call it that, the great Rabbi Akiba, whom Harold Bloom calls the dominant single figure in the entire history of normative Judaism, warned that he who sings the Song of Songs in wine taverns, and I add parenthetically here, or in banquet houses or symposia, treating it as if it were a vulgar song, forfeits his share in the world to come. But that was because Akiba held as follows: the whole world is not worth the day on which the Song of Songs was given to Israel. For all the scriptures are holy, but the Song of Songs is the holy of holies. He's also reported elsewhere to have said, had not the Torah been given, canticles would have sufficed to guide the world. Now that's stunning. That's striking. In the Hebrew Bible, the song is placed among the writings, following Job as the first of the five scrolls, and it is to be read in the synagogue on the eighth day of Passover. I wish I knew and understood more about what that would signify. The massive commentary by Marvin Pope in the Anchor Bible series, 700 pages long, roughly, says of the song that in proportion to its size, it's the second shortest book of the Bible, no book of the Bible has received so much attention, and certainly none has had so many divergent interpretations imposed upon its every word. It was probably the most popular scriptural book for medieval Jews, which could, of course, only demonstrate just how apostate they were, but I wouldn't want to jump to that conclusion too swiftly. Christians rescued themselves from the acute embarrassment of having to explain a book that seemed to praise passionate sexual activity, which was generally believed to be the root of much evil, by means of allegory of a rather strongly Platonistic sort, denying the literal and fleshly sense of the text while asserting a spiritual sense. So the song came to be reckoned one of the most important books by sexually ascetic Christians, according to Jean Leclerc, who's a historian of monasticism. It's the book which was most read and most frequently commented on in the medieval cloister. Well, of course. The Christian tradition begins with Hippolytus around the 2nd century, but maybe most importantly with Origen around the 3rd century, who wrote a ten-volume commentary, which is now only in a small part extant, and who warned in his prologue to that commentary that everyone who is not yet rid of the vexations of flesh and blood and has not ceased to feel the passion of his bodily nature should refrain completely from reading this book. Origen, of course, had taken care of that problem in his own case earlier in his life by taking quite literally Jesus' injunction to cut off the offending member of the body, and thus made himself the ancestor of Levi Peterson's self-castrating character, Jeremy Wyndham, in the Backslider. So perhaps it became a little easier in that way for Origen to read the song allegorically as a purely spiritual drama of the inner life. I'm a little mean to Origen there, I'm sure, but that's the story. Christian commentary just goes on and on in that allegorical vein, Catholic and Protestant, down to very near our own time. Bernard of Clairvaux, for instance, wrote 86 sermons on the song, spent the last 18 years of his life working on it, and died before he finished chapter 2. He was averaging more than 2 sermons per verse for the first 2 chapters there. And Bernard said, "When you think of these 2 lovers, remember always that not a man and a woman are to be thought of, but the Word of God, that is Christ, and a soul." That's in Sermon 61. The story is told by Bernard's contemporary and biographer, William of St. Thierry, that in youth he once exchanged admiring glances with a girl and experienced an erection which so perturbed him that he dunked himself in an icy pond until the tumescence subsided, and there and then he resolved to become a monk. Taking the Song of Songs literally rather than allegorically has apparently been a dangerous thing, historically speaking. Back in, and I'll come back to Bernard and Abelard in a minute. Back in the 4th or 5th century, Jovinian, a monk by the name of Jovinian in the Latin Church, and a cleric by the name of Theodore of Mopsuestia in the Greek Church, both had advocated the literal sense of the text. Jovinian held that the song is full of the idea that marital sexuality is hallowed, and he thus brought down the attack of St. Jerome on him, who insisted that the true meaning of the song is diametrically opposite to the literal meaning. Both Ambrose of Milan and Pope Syricus in Rome condemned Jovinian at councils in Milan and Rome in 395 and 390, respectively. And they condemned him for heresy and blasphemy. And so that was about the end of that. Theodore's beliefs that sexual desire was not inherently impure and that even Jesus had some fleshly impulses were far too radical for his ascetic milieu, and in 553, about a century after his death, the Council of Constantinople condemned his interpretation and anathematized him, and his commentary does not survive. Maybe a little surprisingly, by the way, John Calvin and Martin Luther resisted the allegorical interpretations, but not without trouble. Back to Bernard for a minute. William Phipps sees Bernard's repressed erotic urges resulting in a destructive flood of dark passion in his later life. Cistercians would likely demur on all of this, but I find Phipps rather intriguing, if not persuasive, in seeing Bernard's antipathy toward Peter Abelard as in large part due to a different assessment of human love, of which Abelard had perhaps more experience than Bernard. Abelard believed that natural urges were not sinful due to having inherited contaminated sexuality from Adam's fall. If cohabitation with a wife and the enjoyment of pleasant things were allowed us in paradise from the first day of our creation without guilt being incurred, who may argue that these things are now sinful, provided only that we do not exceed the limits of our permission? Well, outraged by Abelard's criticism of the Augustinian doctrine of original sin, and perhaps motivated as much by Abelard's notorious love life, Bernard requested Pope Innocent to exterminate the fox destroying the Lord's vineyard, rather interestingly expropriating a line from the Song of Songs itself and rewriting it in a more violent allegorical mode. The text of Song 215, which he's quoting there, or rewriting there, simply urges to take or capture the little foxes that spoil the vines with tender grapes. Bernard succeeded in getting Abelard excommunicated and getting his books burned, but he seems to have been unsatisfied with that punishment. He declared in one of his sermons on canticles, Sermon 66, that heretics should be put to death. Peter the Venerable, who interceded on behalf of Abelard and gained permission for him to spend the rest of his days at Cluny, where he read, prayed, and kept quiet, chided Bernard. Peter the Venerable said this to Bernard: "You perform all the difficult religious duties. You fast, you watch, you suffer, but you will not endure the easy ones. You do not love." Arthur McGifford writes of Bernard, "For all his praise of love," and there's nothing greater, by the way, than those 86 sermons. I've sampled them a little bit. He was a violent hater. Bernard wrote that enemies should be thought of not as almost nothing, but as nothing at all. And he claimed in calling for the Second Crusade in his letter to the Bavarians, he claimed that the living God has charged me to proclaim that he will take vengeance upon such as refuse to defend him against his foes. To arms, then, and let the cry of Jeremiah reverberate through Christendom. Cursed be he that withholdeth his sword from blood. Due to his age, Bernard declined the honor of serving as commander-in-chief of that crusade. William Phipps' remarks, "Make war, not love," might have been an appropriate slogan for that saint. Yet Bernard, as he admits, has been singled out by some as one of the most Christ-like persons in church history. Well, that suggests some of the historical, intellectual, personal complexity that surrounds the Song of Songs historically. And the story of Bernard and Abelard seems almost a fable for our own times. So there's an enormous mountain of commentary, most of it allegorical, down to our own time. Some of the more literal commentary in our own time may seem a little silly. There's a recent Protestant writer on the literal side who calls his book on the song Solomon on Sex and seems to take the song as God's own marriage manual. It's actually not a bad idea, even if it sounds a little silly. But I wouldn't go quite that far till I've learned more about the text. The readers, by the way, of the copy in the Harold B. Lee Library, if we can assume they're LDS, I don't know. Anyway, if we can judge by their marginalia, they've taken opposed views of this man's reading. The writer at one point remarks on the fragrance of your garments, Song 4:11, that the verse apparently refers to a flimsy, scant, and perfumed negligee that partly reveals parts of the bride's body, and he comments that Chillamith knew how to dress for bed. Well, one reader has rather dourly written in the margin above that, "Where do you get this?" And another, it seems to me it's clear where it comes from, another has responded in slightly sloppier handwriting, "Don't be such a prude, pal. Enjoy sex." Well, that's another bit of documentary evidence for the Mormon blues. Well, against all of this mountain of traditional Jewish and Christian commentary, which we can, if we wish, just dismiss as so much obsessed apostate fiddling with an uninspired text of disputed canonicity, there is, as far as I know, no Mormon tradition of commentary at all. The visible evidence of that absence, of what we might take as a sort of official church position on the song, is in the current LDS editions of the Scriptures. And it's interesting and instructive to ponder that evidence very briefly, and that's the last part of the statement that I think I want to make, though it's going to sound longer to me than I wanted it to be. The current LDS edition, if I count accurately, and I'm counting separate references within individual footnotes, gives about 20 annotations for the entire Song of Songs. two cross-references to other biblical texts, one of them the obvious reference to 1 Kings 4:32, which summarizes Solomon's literary accomplishments, and the other cross-referencing 2:12, the mention of the voice of the turtle to Jeremiah 8:7. And that's it. There are seven cross-references to other parts of the song itself, including some multiples between chapter 4 and chapter 5. There are eight explanations or alternate translations of idioms, such as henna or gazelle, and particularly my sister, my spouse, which is explained as an idiom to express tenderness, as if we couldn't figure that out. There are two references to the topical guide. 2:12, about the flowers appearing and the voice of the turtle, is referenced to T.G. Nature. And 8:6, which says jealousy is cruel as the grave, is referenced to T.G. Cruelty, overlooking that this line is a questionable Jacobean translation of something that might be rendered passion as fierce as hell. And that's it. Except for nature and cruelty, the song is not, as far as I know, cited in the topical guide. Under the topics I've checked, particularly not under sexual immorality or lust, and that's something to be thankful for, but also not under marriage, and that's something to regret. The chapter heads, or glosses, seem to have been written with half-averted eyes. For chapter 1, the gloss reads, "He sings of love and devotion, though the chapter begins, 'Let him kiss me.'" You blink. Obviously, the gloss "he" refers to the putative author, Solomon, and not to the first voice to sing in the song, which is feminine. But still, it's a little jarring. The heads for chapters 5, 6, and 7, for instance, read, "Their song of love and affection continues," and "They still sing of love, and their song of love continues." That's your interpretive help. You're really on your own here, brother or sister, and good luck. Well, for a contrast, the Bible that I was given in my teens, with a set of LDS-ready references bound into the middle and a little concise encyclopedia abridged from the Cambridge Companion bound into the back just before the concordance, specially bound for the LDS Church and distributed by Deseret Books, so it's a quasi-LDS Bible, let's allow, has, again, if I count accurately and counting in the same way, about 18 annotations for the first chapter alone. Seven cross-references to other texts in the Bible, including, of course, 1 Kings, but also Ecclesiastes, Ezekiel, Psalms, Mark, Isaiah. Five cross-references for that chapter to other parts of the song itself. Six explanations or alternate translations of idioms in that chapter. Of course, no references to any topical guide, but the little encyclopedia in the back includes a half-column summary of the song, interpreting it as a story about Solomon and the Shulamite and her fidelity to her shepherd Swain. That's one of the admittedly dubious attempts to make narrative dramatic sense of the song. The page header glosses in that edition all refer allegorically to the mutual love of Christ and the church. There's not much help there, really, the allegorist for detailed explanation would have to turn to Origen or Bernard or one of the Jewish Kabbalists to get much farther. The most interesting, provocative, and helpful, yet, of course, controversial annotation in this older quasi-LDS edition cross-references Song 8:6, "Love is strong as death," to Romans 8:35, "Who shall separate us from the love of Christ?" Obviously an allegorical cross-reference. Which is, as you'll remember, the inception of Paul's most beautiful, soaring, astonishing, and consoling paean to God's steadfast love of his people, which I think is a text for all times, and maybe especially for times like ours, when so much threatens to separate us all from that love, our own wanderings most of all, perhaps. The most notable note in the post-1979 LDS edition, just below the one for chapter 1, verse 1, reads, "Note, the JST manuscript states that the Songs of Solomon are not inspired writings." This marginal note, which heretofore has not had canonical status, but rather something like midrashic or patristic status, now attains something like canonical status, and at the same time it marginalizes the text it comments on. As we still have the song in our Bibles, but now the note is telling us it's not inspired. Maybe that leaves us free then to just read it and not worry about it. I would say that for Latter-day Saints, the song has become a quarantined text. perhaps no longer a sacred text. Its retention is entailed by our commitment to the Authorized Version, the King James Version, but its binding threads to the rest of sacred scripture have largely been severed. It's a text stapled shut, as I've heard a former missionary say he'd heard was the case with the copy owned by one recent president of the church. Bert Wilson, by the way, my folklorist friend, doesn't believe this and suspects it's just missionary folklore, and that's an assumption that I incline to share. And in current LDS editions, stapling would still leave far too much of the song legible. You could have covered up more of it in my old edition. But it's a leaky quarantine. Or to take my other metaphor, some of those threads don't sever easily. For one thing, there are three direct quotations of Song 6:10. Who is she that looketh forth as the morning, fair as the moon, clear as the sun, and terrible as an army with banners, in the Doctrine and Covenants, 5:14, 105:31, 109:73. So apparently the Lord thought well enough of the song, or at least that verse, to reuse that verse in modern Revelation. And the uses all apply, we might say allegorically, to the restored church. They vary according to context. The first, given at Harmony, Pennsylvania in March 1829, proclaims the beginning of the rising up and the coming forth of my church out of the wilderness, the church which is to be formally organized only within weeks of this particular prophetic word. The second, given amid Zion's camp on Fishing River, Missouri, 22nd of June, 1834, which is at or near the summer solstice, by the way, to speak of clear as the sun, is given in the midst of mob violence against the church in Missouri, and it makes an understandable militaristic expansion of the song's text. But first let my army become very great, and let it be sanctified before me, that it may become fair as the sun and clear as the moon, and that her banners may be terrible unto all nations. The third, embedded in the climactic petition of the revealed dedicatory prayer for the Kirtland Temple, 27 March 1836, again takes up the 1829 theme. And by the way, it's kind of interesting to me that both of these uses occur somewhere near Passover season. March 18, I don't know what to make of that, maybe purely an accident. March 1829, March 1836, roughly 7 years apart, and somewhere near Passover time. Well, the other occurs very near the summer solstice. At any rate, that one takes up that 1829 theme again, that thy church may come forth out of the wilderness of darkness and shine forth fair as the moon, etc. But this time it expands that quotation in the direction of the apocalyptic sacred marriage of Christ the bridegroom and the church his bride, adorned for that day when thou, God, shalt unveil the heavens and cause the mountains to flow down at thy presence, so on and so forth. The sentence actually goes on for several verses in that expansion. So God seems to have made central a portion of the text that his church recently, at his bidding, we must suppose, seems now to make marginal. Well, I suspect we might find other less hugely audible echoes of the song elsewhere in Christian and modern scripture. What of Revelation 3:20, for instance? Behold, I stand at the door and knock, to which my old Bible from my teens cross-referenced Song 5:2. Or, again, is there a rewriting and application, as we might call it, partly by way of Romans 8:35-39, of the song's climactic love is strong as death, in D&C 121, 43, and 44, then showing forth afterwards an increase of love toward him whom thou hast reproved, lest he esteem thee to be his enemy, that he may know that thy faithfulness is stronger than the cords of death. We've tried to silence and marginalize a text that sounds as though it will not stay silent, will insist on binding itself to the core of our faith, hope, and love. Love will not be stilled. William Phipps, in his essay on the song, quotes Jeremiah, a passage whose exact language I can't find in Jeremiah, "The voice of the bridegroom, the voice of the bride, the voices of those who sing." It sounds like a dramatis personae for the song. I can't find that identical phrasing in my authorized version, Jeremiah, but I do rather find this, which looks like a prophecy whose fulfillment we are now living, both textually and maritally. Then will I cause to cease from the cities of Judah and from the streets of Jerusalem the voice of mirth and the voice of the bridegroom and the voice of the bride, for the land shall be desolate. Well, I'm citing that out of context, too, and we don't know why the Lord says he's going to do that. But I think we've been silencing those voices in marginalizing the Song of Songs, driving it out into the wilderness, And our brides and our bridegrooms don't sing songs of mirth for long. And even from the purely literary standpoint, I think there is a good reason to try to approach carefully, reverently, but as honestly as we can, the discourse of eros, of sex, within our culture. And for me, the Song of Songs, I've realized in doing my homework for this and thinking about my own writing and thinking, has come to be the starting point. But as I've said, Margaret and Karen do not need to feel obliged to talk about it directly. I hope that I'm taking too long already.
Bruce, I'm married to Bruce Young. Bruce Jorgensen was my teacher before he was my friend. He has never liked my titles. Love Change is not a working title. It really is the title of that short story collection. And that signature is going to do that this sometime in 1995. I felt nervous enough about some of the stories in Love Change, not with an organic nervousness saying, oh, gee, I don't know if I really want to publish these, but because of some experiences that I've had in publishing some of my works, and I'll talk about those in a minute, that I decided I'd better put a little introduction, sort of a statement of faith at the beginning of these essays. Bruce thinks I should prepare it as a leaflet and have it optional, the optional purchase. If you buy the book and if you're concerned about it and want to know if you need to talk to Margaret Stake, president, here's a leaflet. telling that she actually is a believer, and I am. However, there is sex in a good part of what I write. Bruce Jorgensen even said that he thought of me as one writer who wrote about sex quite a lot, and I said, no, that's absolutely not true. I never write about sex, but I try to be very similar in my writing, and sex is a part of my characters' lives. Not in every single story and not in every single novel, but a very important part of who they are. I'm going to tell a little story about getting offended by something, and this is me getting offended. Don't laugh at this story, or you'll feel stupid as I use it as my metaphor throughout, because I find it an offensive thing. I still do. This is when I was about 19, living in Denver all by myself, working in a little office. And a guy there brought a doll, a plastic doll, of a Catholic monk. And when he pressed the button, a little plastic penis would come out through the robes. Now, I found that so offensive that I was literally sick. It felt like he was treating me with an utter lack of respect, that he was mocking sacred things. Really, I have tremendous respect for monks who do remarkable things in their lives and negate much of their instincts in order to fulfill what they see as their religious calling. So I really could not get over it. In fact, it was a week that when I would think of it, I would just feel, you know, just send chills at me. Well, when I, and they weren't sexual chills, they were offended chills. My first experience having people get offended by my writing came about very innocently. I wrote a story called The Affair. It won a BYU contest. It didn't even occur to me that there was a problem with this story. It's about a woman who gets a phone call from somebody who's surveying deodorant. What kind of deodorant do you use? And as she takes this call and talks to this guy doing this universal market survey, she comes to realize that she doesn't really know how her husband smells, and through that she doesn't really know her husband. And that's, if there's any theme in my works, that's the big theme, that people don't really know each other. It's Levinas, if you know Levinas. But they come to realize, if my fiction works, how precious they are to each other. Well, this was published. One of my students said, we're working on an issue of the Student Review. Do you have a story? And so I said, oh, all right, take this one. Well, the editor of the Student Review resigned the next week with a rather scathing letter saying that he could not function as the editor of a magazine that would publish such a vulgar piece. Well, I was teaching at BYU. My husband was either in a bishopric or on the High Council or something, and there was a temple recommend in my purse, and I felt like people were looking at me saying, that's Bruce Young's wife. She writes porn. and again, I this image of the monk with the plastic penis came, and I saw them perceiving me as the person toying with sacred things, making light of them, mocking them, and having them in real plastic forms. And that was anything but the way I saw myself. Well, it was depressing. I lost sleep over it. And I had a real big reaction to it. I had a story that was coming out in dialogue called Outsiders that also had sex in it. The first story, The Affair, was very implicit. I didn't feel like there was anything really explicit about the sexuality, but I may be naive about some of my stuff. Outsiders dealt with some very difficult, touchy issues, dealt with Blacks in the Priesthood, which had been very troubling to me growing up, and is a pretty close to autobiographical story if you've read that one. It's in Bright Angels and Familiars. Well, when Dialogue took that, I decided I would not have my whole name on that one. So it was M.J. Young. And I saw Richard Craycroft in the grocery store the day after it was published, and he said, "Oh, I enjoyed your story." I said, "My story." "You knew." And I saw Gene England the next day, and he said, "Good story." And I said, "You knew that was mine. I thought if I just used my initials that people wouldn't really get it." And he said, "You know, if you're going to be a writer, you're going to have to face up to the responsibility of it." So when we anthologized Outsiders, I went ahead and put my name on it. Interestingly, when I did a reading of Outsiders, and Kathy Evans was also reading at the same thing, her poetry, and afterwards she said to me, "What a brave thing for you to write." Now that is an interesting word to use to a writer. I don't think of myself as being a brave writer broaching all of these terribly controversial and dangerous issues. I try to approach verisimilitude, and that's the extent of it. And I have to just juxtapose Kathy's comment with the biggest insult I have ever received as a writer, which is when I was doing book signing for House Without Walls, my first book that came out with Deseret Book, and is a very orthodox book, and I'm not ashamed of it. I need to say that people would sort of assume that if I'm writing this kind of fiction that I would be ashamed of any real orthodox fiction that I've written. But that expresses my faith, and I'm grateful to have it. I'm grateful to have something that I can give my laurels for birthday presents and that my grandparents can have in their bookshelves. But when I was doing the signing, a librarian came up and said, "Oh, yes, yeah, I recommended this book to one of my patrons. She's one who doesn't really like to be challenged, and this book looked like it would be safe." Well, can you imagine how that felt? I don't want to be treading thin ice on purpose, you know, setting out to be the writer who is known as, if you pick up a book by Margaret Young, it's going to have all sorts of really challenging, difficult, dangerous issues in it. I would hope that it would have more life than dangerous issues, but life, of course, has dangerous issues as because of what it is. But I certainly, definitely don't want to be known as somebody who is safe. Pick up one of her books, you'll never be offended. She never writes anything that's not safe. And to me, that is, again, exactly what Bruce was talking about, marginalizing these issues that are so hard for us. And I think sex is difficult for us to face because it's so private, and because in a work of literature, you are invited to witness people engaged in sexual activity, whether you're taking a close-up look at it. And I tend to shy away from that because I don't want to write about sex. I just want it to be a part of my characters' lives when it needs to be. And I feel that it, in some works, that it's got to be there. And I'll tell you about the novel that I'm working on now that I'm hoping to get off to a publisher in December or so. I wrote this initially as a young adult novel from the daughter's perspective. I'm going to fill you in 2 minutes on the life story behind this. This is one of those novels that I found that I had to write. My sister-in-law, Bruce's younger sister, she's just 42, has had multiple sclerosis for about 15 years. She has the worst kind of multiple sclerosis you can have, chronic progressive. And she's never had remission. I met her when Bruce and I married 10 years ago, and we went to see her in Hawaii. She was in a wheelchair, but still able to use her arms, still able to speak. Well, in that 10 years, the disease has caused her body to degenerate to such an extent that she has no movement at all and no speech, and she's going blind. She really is turning into a statue. Well, 2 years ago, her husband took her to the airport ostensibly to send her to see her parents and announced there that he thought it was time that she go to a rest home and that maybe it should be in Utah because it would be a little cheaper and she was going there anyway to see her parents. And by the way, they would need to be divorced because rest homes cost a lot of money and Medicaid will only cover if you're a ward of the state. And so that would all need to happen. Well, it wasn't too surprising that 3 days after the divorce was final, he married somebody else. This was going on in my life. I insist on writing time as often as I can get it. And I found that every time I would sit down to write, something to do with multiple sclerosis was coming onto the computer. And I finally said, "This is going to happen." And so I asked permission to do this. It is not her story, but her story is certainly motivated by the story. And I haven't decided on the title yet, and I'm sure Bruce will question it when I do. Right now, today, it's called Dear Stone, but that'll likely change before December. The first story, you know, when I was lying in bed thinking of the story I wanted to write is a story where this guy divorces his wife who has become incapacitated because of multiple sclerosis. Then he gets in a car accident and he becomes a quadriplegic and he gets sent to the same rest home as she does. Now, can you tell the problem with that story? That is a vindictive story. And we don't do that. Not if you're trying to be good. You don't put black hats and white hats on your characters, and you don't have somebody come to the great epiphany that I am really a jerk, you know that? And I'm really sorry that I did all of this to you. Those are the kinds of stories we make up in our fantasies when we're kids, or probably when we're adults too, when somebody has offended us and we want them to recognize how deeply we've been hurt and what a terrible person they really are. Well, the issue for me as I started writing this and tried to look at the father of the story, and because I'm fictionalizing, it's not the real father, became sex. What would it really be to have your wife incapacitated in that way? You deal with her sexual organs, but you deal with them only because you help her go to the bathroom. What would it be like to have that? And to move into his mind and to not portray him as a jerk, but as a human being who is not able, is in a marriage where his sexual needs cannot be met, and he's watching his wife turn to stone before his eyes. I'll read you just a little bit of this. These are not terribly sexy passages, and because I'm still in process of writing, they're not finished passages either. As he looks at her lying on the couch, and he can imagine her when he's seeing her just lying there on the couch. He can imagine her sitting up, asking about his day's classes, his burdens, could imagine the two of them merging thoughts and then merging bodies, arms, legs, flesh to flesh, bone to bone, fecund celebrations of movement and form. There was no merging now, save in dreams. Did she have them, too? When her speech first went, he had thought he could read her mind, and they communicated with looks mostly for months. But as her thoughts became more complex, and she insisted on expressing them, insisted on his patience spelling with her, moving down the alphabet, breaking language down to letters and communication to a blink, he found himself exhausted, found himself finishing her sentences and not waiting for her corrections. He knew her better than he knew anyone in the world, but she had entered a realm he could not know. Like her language, like her body, their together life was breaking down into increments of loss. He mourned everyone, the sound she could make a month ago, but no longer, the increasing stiffness in her hands, the loss of her neck muscles. The disease was a steady pendulum, and he the accountant of all the down dominoes in its way. Skipping a few, Mary's form was more symbol than body now, and her soul, the Mary of his memory and dreams and imagination, ungraspable as water. In the course of this novel, he has an affair with the nurse who's taking care of Mary. And there are sex scenes between the two of them. I really hope they're not as titillating as they are painful. Because I see this as a pained kind of sexuality. And eventually, I even bring him back to Mary, which is not what's happened in real life. When I was thinking, and I'm going to finish up in 2 minutes here, when I was thinking about sex in stories I've written, sex in other literature, for example, Levi Peterson's, and recognizing, having to, that, yeah, it is marginalized, it is stigmatized, people get very nervous about it. People would say, oh, I'd let my daughter marry, read that, but only if she's married. And I can kind of relate to some of that. Some of my fiction I would prefer that my kids not read yet. I'd like to wait until they're a little bit further along in their lives and they've had some experiences that will help them understand things. One thing that occurred to me was that a lot of our writing about eroticism or sexuality deals with real rural characters. Levi Peterson has kind of cowboy-esque characters in a lot of his writing, and I think we kind of can give permission to very rural characters. There's a real say anything woman in my ward at home who once opened a Sunday school lesson saying, "Brothers and sisters, we live in the world of the almighty dollar and the almighty orgasm." And I turned to my husband and said, "What did she say?" He said, "Well, she said we live in the world of the almighty dollar and the almighty orgasm." And that's not how you expect Sunday school to get started, but you have to know the woman who was saying it. We cut her some slack because she's who she is. And I think, likewise, we cut a little slack with some of the rural characters. I think some of my fiction, I have a story called God on Donahue that I think was directly inspired by Levi Peterson's The Third Nephite, and it's very rural characters. I even thought about Shakespeare, who has somebody like Iago refer to making the beast with two backs. And they'll talk very directly about sex. The more elevated characters tend not to. They tend to be a bit more dignified in their discussion of romance. But as I thought about it, I thought, well, I don't think that it's that we won't talk about sex unless we can have somebody real rural, real down to earth, real, you know, somebody who's going to be messing around with manure in his spare time, shoveling it, or whatever farmers are going to be doing. I don't think that it's just that we'll let those people talk about it and so we'll reserve sexual topics for those people. I think it's that writers, and especially Mormon writers, with this vision of exalted sexuality and the idea, and this is something that I don't hesitate to teach my own children and teach kids in Sunday school, the idea that sex is sacred. But we're living in the real world, and so what writers are going to do, and I think you will see this, I think if you think about the literature you've read that is by a Mormon writer but that deals with sexuality, you will see them bringing that sacred image down to earth. And it'll be an earthy person, often, who will come right out and say certain things that you wouldn't expect somebody to say, somebody who would have a lot of dignity. But that's a lot of what we're about, anyway. Writing is about conflict. It is about the collision between heaven and earth. And for it to work well, we cannot stay in the realm of the vision. It's important. We can use that for commentary. We can use that in testimony meeting. But writers are about what happens here on earth and the conflict in the human heart, the conflict between earth and heaven. And so we will bring that image down. And I think the Song of Solomon is marginalized in some ways because it is so tangible and so present and sexual. And even though it is sacred, it merges those two worlds in a way that can be quite frightening. I wanted to finish off in 30 seconds by reading a little passage from Toni Morrison, who is one of my very favorite authors. And this, I think, is what a lot of Mormon writers and probably all of us are reacting against, the idea that the body can be hated. Again, and I haven't brought the little monk back inside, but there's that disparity. What Mormon fiction really is about a lot of times is people with sacred clothes, sacred garments, dealing with their sexual feelings, and that's a tremendous conflict. And it's the same one as the little plastic monk, except that it's not a toy. If the fiction is working, it's very similar, and we're dealing with flesh and blood people, dealing with life and death, as they sense it, life and death spiritual conflicts. This, of course, beloved, is set during slave years, and she's talking to, this is Baby Suggs Holy, talking to people about how they need to feel about their bodies. And she talks about how outside they hate your bodies. And we can have a sense either that sex is a dirty secret or that it's so sacred that it's not really touchable, at least not that we would talk about in any kind of a public setting. And some people would consider that we wouldn't write about it either because of that privacy and because it's so sacred. And this, although it's not directly about sex, I think is the message that I bet if Levi Peterson were given a chance to say something didactic, this would be his message. Here, she said, in this here place, we flesh. Flesh that weeps, laughs, flesh that dances on bare feet in grass. Love it. Love it hard. Yonder, they do not love your flesh. They despise it. They don't love your eyes. They just as soon pick them out. No more do they love the skin on your back. Yonder, they flay it. And, oh, my people, they do not love your hands. Those they only use, tie, bind, chop off, and leave empty. Love your hands. Love them. Raise them up and kiss them. Touch others with them. Pat them together. Stroke them on your face, because they don't love that either. You got to love it, you. And no, they ain't in love with your mouth. Yonder out there, they will see it broken and break it again. What you say out of it, they will not heed. What you scream out of it, they will not hear. What you put into it to nourish your body, they will snatch away and give you leavens instead. No, they don't love your mouth. You got to love it. This is flesh I'm talking about here. Flesh that needs to be loved. Feet that need to rest and to dance. Backs that need support. Shoulders that need arms. Strong arms, I'm telling you. And, oh, my people, out yonder, hear me, they do not love your neck unnoosed and straight. So love your neck. Put a hand on it. Grace it. Stroke it. And hold it up. And all your inside parts that they just as soon slop for hogs, you got to love them. The dark, dark liver, love it, love it. And the beat and the beating heart, love that too. More than eyes or feet. More than lungs that have yet to draw free air. More than your life-holding womb and your life-given private parts. Hear me now. Love your heart, for this is the prize.
I'm a lot shorter than Bruce Jorgensen. Sorry about the noise. Okay, I'll. Can you hear me all right? Anyone have anything to say? Any questions or comments? I've been thinking all week what I was going to say here, and I'm less certain about it now than I was an hour ago. Listening to these things, a thousand things are going through my mind. Maybe I'd like to read just for a few minutes, simply because I'd like to compile I'd like to trust the words that are in front of me rather than trust what comes out randomly at this point. Then I'd like to maybe just talk about some responses. This is from the essay that Bruce Jorgensen mentioned, Near Sex Experiences. It's subtitled Confessions of a Mormon Girl. My husband Mark and I were lying in bed about a year ago, about the time we delivered our third child, and right after I'd been able to break from a very difficult semester of teaching and being pregnant and raising two children at the same time. And it was a good year. It's been a year that we've had time to talk and to reassess and to think. And we lay awake one night laughing about all of the stupid things we did before we were married, all the things we didn't know, all the ways we had, all the things we had no measurements for in understanding situations we were in. It originally started as something very amusing, and as it finally occurred to me to write about something like that, I realized it's not entirely humorous, but it's also something that I realized there was a much stronger range of emotions and a longer range of wider range of experiences than I'd imagined. Let me read just a few sections here, and then I'll maybe follow up. I don't understand sex. I still don't. I know how it's done, more or less. You don't have three kids without learning something. I mean, I don't understand the big picture. Sex gets more confusing the more I know. I thought I was learning something in high school, for example. My friend Shelley seemed like an authority. It's not that I didn't know the basics. My mom's a nurse. She sat me down with my sister when we were 10 and 11 and asked me, after we'd asked her what the word meant. We'd seen it scratched on the wall of the elementary school bathroom. She explained it all, complete with diagrams of the uterus and penis, with little long-tailed sperm swimming toward the egg. I wish I would have saved that picture. My mom didn't draw very often. Mom made it clear that sex was for marriage. You don't give the most precious thing you own away to just anybody, she said. Besides, there are some things about you, some things you only want someone you really trust to know about you. I thought, she meant, that I would want no one but my husband to ever know that I would actually take off my clothes in front of a man. But my new friend Shelley was the first person I knew who suggested that there might be more to it than the clinicals. She claimed that there was a lot to sex between a kiss and an entry that I had yet to dream of. She said her brother had gotten two girls pregnant. I'm not certain now why that assured me she knew so much. She'd moved from Salt Lake City with her parents, who thought that bringing her to a small town with only Mormons would diminish her opportunities to try sex and drugs. It did for a while. Not like sex didn't exist in the valley, of course. Plenty of evidence that it did. Anyway, Shelley and I got in the habit of sloughing seminary, since it didn't count toward graduation, and going to her boyfriend's house for the hour, sometimes more. Gordon lived right near the high school. He'd dropped out a long time ago and was hanging out at his dad's house until he could get established as a rock star. We didn't do much, just watched TV and made macaroni and cheese. Sometimes Shelley and Gordon made out on the couch during commercials. Sometimes they disappeared in the back room and I didn't hear much. I wished I had a boyfriend, mostly so I could tell Shelley to shut up once in a while and quit thinking she was the only one who knew anything about male anatomy, but I was forced to trust her. I go on with several experiences that affect me more profoundly now that I've written about them than I think did at the particular time. But what I'd like to maybe focus the rest of my comments on is just a small section here where I talk about some of the baggage I bring from my own community. Speaking of rural characters, I grew up in Alpine, Utah. That's my hometown, and that's where I learned most of my attitudes and mores regarding sex. So let me recite just a few things that, or review just a few things that occurred peripherally in my long sex education. 7 years into marriage, I'm just beginning to understand how much baggage we bring, virgin or no, into a long-term sexual relationship. I thought I was coming to marriage with a fairly light load, but an honest inventory suggests otherwise. I will probably never understand the full weight I drag. So maybe I didn't inherit an enormous sex guilt connection from my parents. I did take on their attitude that making a bigger deal of anything than absolutely necessary is despicable. Besides skiing, despising the fanatical is my family's one fanaticism. That's a big trunk, heavy enough to pull around on wheels, heavy enough to keep them from ever attending a Sunstone conference. And there's plenty of sexual paraphernalia locked, maybe irretrievably, inside. I picked up plenty of carry-ons from growing up in a small, strictly Mormon community. We're not all as crazy as old Jacob Gutman, but his kind does tend to trail us around. I remember Jacob standing up in church and pounding his fist on the pulpit. The woman is long on the hair and short in the brains. The man is to guide and can. Do not fall for the temptations of the woman. And children, Santa Claus is a dirty lie. When I was just old enough to comprehend her story, I recall Jacob's wife, Clara, telling us in testimony meeting in an accent as thick as her husband's, although she had been born and raised in Alpine like my grandma, about a fateful night in their family history. She had dreamed of a beautiful baby boy. They had 6 daughters and only 2 sons, who had spoken to her even though he was only an infant. He told her to wake his daddy up quick because he was chosen to come to their family. This was serious business with a couple who never wallowed in filthy intercourse unless they were fairly certain it would result in offspring, lust, soul justification. Trembling, Clara woke her husband, who, surprised into action, lost control too soon. And he spilled the seed on the sheets, Clara wailed. It was all spilled, and we lost the beautiful baby boy. Jacob sat upright, pale and chastened. I personally was relieved, unwilling to welcome another Gutman boy to the neighborhood, mean as his brother. My sister and I later wondered how much seed had been spilled on the sheets after such a long wait. Their youngest child was 8. I carry mace in my baggage, although I can never find it when I need it, to ward off potential sex fiends. I learned young that you never know who will turn out to be one. Like Lamar Warnock, a frail, quiet guy, the last you'd ever suspect. But in Alpine, we knew better because my uncle and his pals, when they were 13, were wandering through Lamar's apple orchard with nothing to do but break the padlock on his shed. They discovered a trove of Playboy magazines, so many they didn't guess he'd miss a few. They each took some home, traded them back and forth until somebody's parents found out. Boy, was Lamar in trouble. He had to go see the bishop, who made him go to each kid and his parents and apologize. No wonder I don't trust men. No wonder I don't even know who not to trust. I even carry saddlebags. When I was 14, I rode with my dad in the pickup to take our mare to be bred. We eased her backward out of the trailer. I led her to an empty stall. Then I followed my father and Bill Milden through the stables to see the high, blue-eyed stallion they had chosen to sire the colt. He reared and whinnied at our approach, so hot and wild. He seemed to be throwing off sparks. He made my pulse leap, my legs weak. I wanted to stay and watch, but Milburn said, I don't think that's the kind of thing a young lady would really want to see. I felt the blood rush to my face. I'd seen horses do it before. The big mare and the skinny no-breed stallion in the pasture by the elementary school were always at it, at least half-heartedly. He'd mount, and she'd kick him away. He'd come back with hoof scrapes on his bony shoulders, begging for more. By then, Sister Higby would come out of her house with a broom, shaking at us to get on home before she called our mamas. We'd scatter and watch sideways as we walked along the fence. Dad and I left the mare at Milden's and went home, planning to retrieve her in a week. That next Tuesday night at the weekly church youth meeting, the boys my age seemed particularly interested in addressing me. Turned out that Bill Milden had invited the scout troop out for an educational activity. We watched your horse get pregnant, John Jensen grinned. Kent Jolly snickered behind him. You should have seen him go after her, Kent exploded. Geez, I thought he was gonna... Shut up, jerkface. John gave him a slug. Kent's freckled face turned red, and he staggered away, laughing too hard to catch his breath. I saw him again later with Brett and Jason, whispering and gesturing at the end of the hall. They stopped when they saw me, guffawed, and disappeared around the corner. Gall, said my friend Laurie, smoothing her hair. What's with them? I told her I didn't know. Maybe I didn't. I was in school the day Dad brought the mare back to the pasture behind my grandma's house. I walked through the apple orchard to give her oats and brush her down. She nickered and nuzzled like she always did, apparently unaltered, but I caressed her more gently than usual, then sat on the stile and cried for no reason. So what does all this amount to? I'm not certain. Like I said, I don't understand sex, but at least I understand that much. It took a while just to recognize my ignorance. I guess recognizing my ignorance is my premise on discussing Eros in Mormon literature today. I think that we are all for Bruce Jorgensen's commendable confidence that we are all experts. I think maybe otherwise. My only expertise is in my own experience, and like all other things that matter to me, all other things that confuse me, all other things that are difficult and perplexing to me, I need stories that precede mine. I need stories to help understand mine and to put mine into context. I need stories to compare and contrast to mine. Obviously, this is extremely difficult for us when we are discussing a subject that is highly private, highly intimate, something that we must learn to trust each other within a dual relationship or an intimate relationship. It's hard to understand how to bring that into the realm of public discussion and then draw it back into the very private and the very intimate. I don't know the answers. I don't know how to do that, but I do think it's interesting, as Bruce mentioned the other day, it's intriguing how this particular piece of writing is something that's becoming more and more public, originated in something that was very, very personal and very intimate between my husband and me. Something that has drawn a great deal of understanding. I find also that the standard responses for women who read this essay, not standard, but a very, very common one, is one that surprised me. When I started writing this, I wrote it as sort of a joke on myself. I started looking at it because I really thought I was the only person in the world who was so naive, so inexperienced, so clueless as a teenager, and so willing to completely believe my parents and my community on the mores of that society. As I look at it now and I hear the responses of many women who've read this, they've said, I know, yes, this, and respond almost instantaneously with stories of their own. This comes from young and old women. It comes from married and unmarried women. And I think that what surprised me most about writing this essay is that, first of all, it had never occurred to me to write something like this. I don't think it's terribly profound. It's finally my definitive piece on sex by any means. But it surprised me once I started writing this. I kept asking myself, why hasn't this ever occurred to me before? Most of the things I write, I've been planning to write on. I've been thinking about these things for years. I have not had anything articulate in my mind. The series of experiences that I've tried to string together in this essay are experiences that up until the point I wrote it, I had never connected and never associated with each other. I don't understand why, except that, again, this is one area in which my language and my ability to make the jumps, the correspondences between experience and literature, so to speak, the circuits haven't been there. Now, again, I don't know if this is my personal experience. I don't know if this is universal experience. But as I've written this and as I've gone back and thought through the effects of writing it and thought about things that I'd like to write beyond, I do realize that there is a remarkable canon of Mormon literature that does deal with the erotic, that many times we're oblique, many times we're sideways, but as I consider the range, for example, Maureen Whipple in The Giant Joshua, the consummation of Clary's marriage is horrifying enough to be classified in my mind as a rape. To possibly Virginia Sorensen's the Evening and the Morning Star, which is a long-term examination of the effects of fidelity and infidelity in generations of marriages. To Linda Sillitoe's short story, for example, Coyote Tracks, where in a very powerful, very intimate moment that in all of our cultural mindsets would be illicit and evil, is probably one of the most transcendent realizations of love and forgiveness that I've ever read. We have a broad range. You know, we always classify Bruce and Levi as the fine definitive writers on Mormon eroticism. We have a great deal, but I guess what had not sparked for me until recently is the mind and the awareness and the consciousness to recognize it, to see it, and read it and draw it into my own experience. Up until now, for some reason, those circuits have been closed. So I'd like to suggest that we just talk about sex more. I don't know how. I think we need to talk about it, first of all, between ourselves and our sexual partners. And that's a painful conversation. It's a difficult conversation. It's one that will be ongoing. We need to prepare our children more. I really think that much of the pain and the long-term effects of the difficulties in any of our relationships certainly become from being simply unprepared in any realistic way for the complexities. I was unprepared to understand that my sexual relationship would be the key to success many times in our entire marital relationship. I thought it was a 10% factor. It's a much bigger issue than I ever imagined. But I haven't even been able to articulate that until much more recently, until far into my marriage when a lot of damage, I think, had been done. I think we also need to talk about it among each other in ways that are non-harmful, in ways that are not breaches of intimacy, but in ways of understanding and drawing ourselves as a community into more intimate circles with each other. And finally, I think moving from that oral tradition, I believe we need to write with no apologies, with no pretense, and with no didacticism. Simply, we need the experience. We can draw the meaning from the experience if we have it written down, if we have recorded, and if we share it with each other. So.
We do have, I guess, maybe 10 minutes or less, don't we? There may be questions or responses from the audience. I would like to make just one hardly final comment. It seems to me that another starting point for any discussion of this within a Mormon context would have to be D&C 8815. The spirit and the body are the soul of man. One of the things that means to me is that we must be very careful of our language whenever we speak of the body, not to treat it as secondary, as somehow less than the spirit. The spirit and the body are the soul. So that, for instance, when Song of Songs says, "By night on my bed I sought him whom my soul loveth." Now, the Hebrew word may not mean quite what the Mormon word soul is now supposed to mean, but it does mean something rather large. It has seemed to me that a lot of our rather ordinary and casual language about these things is frighteningly reductive. When I hear the expression, "Oh, that's sex," or "just sex," or "mere sex," or "sex is just fleshly desire," I wonder how a person can say that. For the Greeks, eros did not mean simply sexual desire. It meant a desire for and a delight in the entire presence of the beloved. They had another word to talk about genital pleasure, ta aphrodisia, cognate with the name of Aphrodite. Eros meant something larger. Freud wanted it to mean something larger. He needed a term larger than sexual instinct, and he landed on eros, capitalized. He revived, according to Hesiod, one of the most ancient gods of all. to try to talk about really what was ultimately a little two-character mythology that Freud constructs late in his career, Eros and Death. Those are the powers for him in his sort of, you know, atheist mythology that he constructs late in his career. So that it troubles me. you know, someone says, oh, that's just skin on skin. I think I'm shocked and appalled. How can anyone who has begun to know another person sexually, and as soon as I use the adverb I'm introducing the reductive term, ever say such a thing as that? We're talking about the soul, not just about the mere body. I think Mormon scripture warns us not to talk or think like that. God died for the sake of our bodies. That is, our souls. So that strikes me. And I do find, even in Levi Peterson, when Pickett and Pansy in his story Night Soil, she helps him wash, and she turns her back while he washes his dainties. And then she surreptitiously strips while he's doing this. And then she says, Pickett, am I pretty? And he says, oh, Lord, just like a sunrise. Well, who is she that looketh forth fair as the morning, clear as the moon, and terrible as an army with banners? Pickett, in his own way, is echoing the Song of Songs. And I think that is where we start. Anyway, I've said far too much of that. I mean, I could say hours more. I've been thinking hard. But please, if there's a comment from the audience or if somebody wants to add something, we do may as well fill the rest of the time. Yeah. Oh, well, the trouble with publishing is the odds are anywhere from 100 to 1 or to 1,000 to 1 against you. You know, I mean, just that's just reality. The last story of mine that I published, which is I refer to it as a Mormon marital sexual comedy. I have wanted to write. The sex I want to write about is marital sex. I may write about illicit sex sometime, and I've started but never got very far with trying to write stories that deal with that, but I'm interested in how married people relate, and I want to write Mormon domestic comedy. I hope it's not tragedy all the time. So I wrote this rather rambunctious story too many years ago, and finally got confident enough about it a little over a year ago that I sent it to a good magazine in Denver that's not, you know, it's a Gentile magazine. And bless my soul, the editor loved it. You know, he published it. And I'm immensely grateful. But if you want to reach a Mormon audience, you're pretty much stuck with Sunstone and Dialogue. Wasatch Review, but they get nervous a little bit if Margaret writes something. So it is. We're kind of limited. I don't think. Oh, the one that I'm. Oh, it's called High Plains Literary Review. It was their spring 1994 issue. And I'm like Margaret, too. My evil twin writes and publishes my fiction. His name is Wayne. I've always liked that name, but I've never known what to do with it. It's my middle name. And so Wayne writes and publishes the fiction and the poems and so forth. And Bruce teaches, and BW writes criticism. I mean, you might as well have several identities. It is, and it's unfortunate, of course. I think there is a kind of stigma attached to doing it. And yet it seems important. I mean, yeah. Well, that's a good question. Are there people who write comically and hopefully outside of, you know, just out there in the world? I'll name some writers that I admire and value. Reynolds Price, in his novel Good Hearts, writes about a marriage that is broken and healed. And it's one of the most moving things I've ever read. But be careful. There are words in there that some of you will object to. There are words that I have not used yet in writing and would not normally use except in very private conversation. Reynolds Price, P-R-I-C-E, Good Hearts, published about 1988. His student, Josephine Humphreys, her very first novel, which is called Dreams of Sleep, is about a marriage getting healed. I think there's a lot of hopeful work out there. Lynn Sharon Schwartz has a long, massively intelligent novel called Disturbances in the Field, which again is about a marriage being harmed and gradually healing. I admire the work of Rose Ellen Brown, her novel Civil Wars. The thing I admire about Brown when she writes about, and she doesn't write much about her characters' sexual experiences or lives, is that if two characters make love in Rose Ellen Brown, or in Reynolds Price, or in Joe Humphreys, or in Frederick Bush, so many other writers I can think of, it is never generic. It is never the cliches of silhouette desire. You know, it is Jesse and I forget Jesse's husband's name in Civil Wars, making love this time. This one time, there is nothing generic about it. It's incredibly specific and particular, and it is non-clinical. It is the full character, the full personality of the character, and that makes it really shocking, or it can make it really shocking and disturbing. It won't just give you titillation. I mean, that's what I'm looking for in literature is, can anyone imagine marriage? Carolyn Heilbrun says she thinks people can't. I want to do a course where I explore that. I don't know if they'll let me, but I think Rose Ellen Brown does it. Lynn Sharon Schwartz, there are people who do it. Yeah, in the back here, people that might help them avoid pain and damage in their marriages. And I think most of us know some pain. I don't know any marriage. I don't know many marriages well, anyway. But I never picked up a clue about any other marriage or my own. Of course, I know my own very well, but not as well as I should. That in which there isn't some sexual pain. That's just part and parcel of it, maybe. I mean, that's one of the things that the Song of Solomon says. It does suggest pain. And the ancient poets know about this, too. I don't know. I don't hold out much hope for literature helping. I've sometimes... Well, when I first read Jane Eyre at age 40, I said to myself, "You stupid. You grew up and you didn't read this book because it was a girl's book. Of all the dumb reasons not to read a great classic because it was a girl's book and you were a boy." I said to myself, you might have understood a little bit better what was on girls' minds if you'd read Jane Eyre when you were 16. Would Tolstoy help? I don't know that literature would help, because what I find is my students can't read it. And none of us really can. I mean, it takes effort. And when my students meet a frank passage about, say, marital sex, as in Reynolds Price, who, by the way, is much, much tamer than his exact contemporaries, John Updike and Philip Roth, basically they avert their